After a full morning of walking through the Old Town Square and up the Royal Way, I might well be sick of churches, and I'm ready for visiting the most important piece of ground in all of Poland, Wawel. Wawel is a symbol of Polish royalty and independence, and is sacred territory to every Polish person. A castle has stood here since the beginning of Poland's recorded history. Today, Wawel is the most visited site in the country. A stroll through the cathedral and around the castle grounds requires no tickets. With the help of Rick Steve's commentary, I'll be able to walk around his self-guided tour. The mini museums on Wawel are only mildly interesting and probably can be skipped. When Krakow was part of the Habsburg Empire in the 19th century, the Austrians turned this castle complex into a fortress, destroying much of its beauty. When Poland regained its independence after World War I, the castle was returned to its former glory. The bricks that I saw on my left as I climbed up the ramp bear the names of Poles from around the world who donated to this cause. The jaunty equestrian statue ahead is Thaddeus Kosciuszko, again, that familiar name to American history buffs. Kosciuszko was a hero of the American Revolution and helped design West Point. When he returned to Poland, he fought unsuccessfully against the Russians during the partitions that would divide Poland's territory among three neighboring powers. Hiking through the gates next to the statue, I'll pass the ticket office, and if I go to any of the museums, I use the other ticket office with shorter lines on the top of the hill. I can buy any of these tickets at the tourist center at the far corner of the castle grounds, across the field from the cathedral near the cafe. First stop, Wawel Cathedral. Wawel is Poland's national church. While the history buried here is pretty murky to most Americans, to Poles, this church is the national mausoleum. It holds the tombs of nearly all of Poland's most important rulers and greatest historical figures. If I go around the far side of the cathedral, I can take in its profile. This uniquely eclectic church is the product of centuries of haphazard additions, yet somehow it seems to work. It began as a simple, stripped-down Romanesque church in the 12th century. In fact, the white base of the nearest tower is original. In fact, again, anything at Wawel that's made of white limestone like this was probably part of the earliest Romanesque structures. Casimir the Great and his predecessors gradually surrounded the cathedral with some 20 chapels, which were further modified over the centuries, making this church a happy hodgepodge of styles. To give me a sense of the historical sweep, I can scan the chapels from left to right. It's 14th century Gothic, 12th century Romanesque, the base of the tower, 17th century Baroque. The inside is Baroque, though the exterior is a copy of its Renaissance neighbor, 16th century Renaissance, and 18th and 19th century neoclassical. This variety in styles is even more evident in the chapel's interiors. I need to pay attention to the two particularly interesting dome chapels to the right of the tall tower. The gold one is the Sigmund's Chapel, housing memorials to the Jagiellonian kings, including Sigismund the Old, who was responsible for Krakow's Renaissance renovation in the 16th century. Poles consider this chapel, made with 80 pounds of gold, to be the finest Renaissance chapel north of the Alps. The green chapel next to it, home to the Swedish Vasa dynasty, resembles its neighbor, but it's a copy built 150 years later and without all the gold. The tallest tower, called the Sigismund Tower, has a clock with only an hour hand. If I go back around and face the front entry for more architectonic silliness, I'll see Gothic chapels flanking the door, a Renaissance ceiling, lavish Baroque decoration over the door, and some big bones, thought to have come from extinct animals. Years ago, these were taken for the bones of giants and put here as an oddity to be viewed by the public. Back then, there were no museums, so notable items like these were used to lure people to the church. It's said that as long as the bones hang here, the cathedral will stand. The door is the original from the 14th century with fine wrought iron work. The K with the crown stands for Casimir the Great. The black marble frame is made of Krakow stone from nearby quarries. I can walk around the main part of the church for free, but I do need to buy a ticket to be able to climb up the tallest tower or visit the crypt and the royal tombs. I can buy that ticket at the house across from the cathedral entry, where I can also rent an audio guide. Let's go inside the church. The cathedral interior is slathered in Baroque memorials and tombs. It's decorated with tapestries and soaked in Polish histories. After I step inside, I'll follow the one-way clockwise route that leads me through the choir, then around the back of the apse, then back to the entry. At the entry, look straight ahead to see the silver tomb under a canopy inspired by the one in St. Peter's at the Vatican. It contains the remains of the first Polish saint, Stanislaw, from the 11th century. If I go behind this canopy into the ornately carved choir area, I'll see an area that for 200 years, the colorful chair to the right of the high altar has been the seat of Krakow's archbishops, including Pope John Paul, who served here for 14 years before becoming Pope. Now, I can continue into the left nave. Here, if I have a ticket, I can enter two of the optional attractions. Claustrophobic wooden stairs lead up to the 11-ton Sigismund Bell and the pleasant views of the steeples and spires of Krakow. Then, closer to the front of the church, descend into the little crypt with the rare, purely Romanesque interior, which houses the remains of Adam Mickiewicz, the Romantic poet whose statue dominates the main square. Otherwise, continue around the apse and behind the main altar. After curving around to the right, look for the red marble tomb. It's on the right of the Great One, Kazimierz, of course. Look for Kazimierz Wielki. At his feet is what appears to be a beaver. A few more steps toward the entrance on the right is the white sarcophagus of St. Jadwiga, with a dog at her feet. This 14th century king of Poland helped Christianize Lithuania, fought the Teutonic Knights, kicked off the Grand Jagiellonian dynasty, and was sainted by Pope John Paul II in 1997. The sexist bigwigs of the time begrudgingly allowed her to take the throne, but refused to call her a queen. All the flowers here prove she remains popular with Poles. Across from Jadwiga, peek into the gorgeous 16th century Sigismund Chapel with the silver altar. This is the gold roof chapel that I saw from outside. Just beyond the Sigismund Chapel is a door leading back outside. If I don't have a ticket, my tour is finished. I can circle back around and take my time. To the left of the main door, take a good look at the Gothic chapel with its Orthodox-style 14th century frescoes. In the back corner of the church is the entrance to the royal tombs. I'll actually exit outside the church, so be sure I'm done in here first. The first big room houses Poland's greatest war heroes, Kościuszko of the American Revolution fame, Jan III Zabriskie, who successfully defended Vienna from the Ottomans, in the simple black coffin with the gold inscription J3S, Sikorsky, Poniatowski, and many more. Then you'll wander through several rooms of second-tier Polish kings, queens, and their kids. Marshal Józef Piłsudski, the World War I hero who seized power and ruled Poland from 1926 to 35, has the last grave in the room on the right just before you exit. His tomb was moved here so the rowdy soldiers who came to pay their respects wouldn't disturb the others. I might notice that there's one VIP, very important Pole, who's missing. John Paul II, once the bishop of this cathedral. John Paul II left no specific request for his body, and the Vatican, controversial rules at least, chose to entomb him under St. Peter's Basilica instead of sending him back home to Babel. Up the little staircase across from the cathedral entry is the Cathedral Museum. This small museum features various holy robes and replicas of what's buried with the kings, plus Sigismund's original bell clapper. This is all covered by the 10 Zloty Cathedral ticket. After I've finished with the cathedral, I'll exit and be able to stroll around the Babel Castle grounds. In the rest of the castle, I'll uncover more fragments of Krakow's history and have the opportunity to visit several museums. While Steve considers the museum skippable, I might be interested in visiting the royal staterooms. If so, then I need to buy the ticket before I enter the inner courtyard. Purchase the ticket now and restart the narrative when I'm ready to enter the courtyard. Behind the cathedral, a grand green and pink entryway leads into the palace's dramatically Renaissance-style inner courtyard. If this space seems to have echoes of Florence, that's because it was designed and built by young Florentines after Casimir's original castle burned down. Notice the three distinct levels. The ground floor housed the private apartments of the higher nobility, like governors and castle administrators. The middle level held the private apartments of the king. And the top floor, much taller to allow more light to fill his large spaces, were the public staterooms of the king. The ivy-covered wing to the right of where I entered served as the headquarters of the notorious Nazi governor of the German-occupied Poland, Hans Frank. He was tried and executed in Nuremberg after the war. At the far end of the courtyard is a false wall designed to create a pleasant Renaissance cemetery and also to give the illusion that the castle is bigger than it is. Looking through the windows, notice there's nothing but air on the other side. When foreign dignitaries visited, these windows could be covered to complete the illusion. The entrances to most Babel museums are around this courtyard, and some believe that I'll find something even more special, chakra. Adherents to the Hindu concept of chakra believe that a powerful energy field connects all living things. Some believe that, mirroring the seven chakra points on the body from head to groin, there are seven points on the surface of the earth where this energy is most concentrated. Delhi, Delphi, Jerusalem, Mecca, Rome, Velehrad, and Babel Hill. Over there in the corner, immediately to my left as I enter the courtyard, is the spot. Look for peaceful people here or elsewhere on the castle grounds with their eyes closed. One thing's for sure, they're not thinking of Casimir the Great. The smudge marks on the wall are from people pressing up against this corner trying to absorb some good vibes from this chakra spot. The Babel administration seems creeped out by all of this. They've done what they can to discourage this ritual, such as putting up information boards right where the power is supposedly most focused. But believers still gravitate from far and wide to hug the wall. I think I'll go ahead and give it a try and let the force be with me. And just for fun, maybe I'll ask a Vavel tour guide about the chakra and watch her squirm because they're forbidden to talk about it. In the meantime, as I look around the courtyard, let me learn a little more about Casimir the Great. Casimir the Great lived from 1333 to 1370, and out of the many centuries of Polish kings, only one earned the nickname Great, and he's the only one worth remembering. K the G, who ruled Poland from Krakow in the 14th century, was one of those larger-than-life medieval kings who left his mark on all fronts, from war to diplomacy, art patronage to womanizing. His scribes bragged that Casimir found a Poland made of wood and left one made of brick and stone. He put Krakow on the map as a major European capital. He founded many villages, some of which still bear his name, and replaced wooden structures with stone ones, such as Krakow's Cloth Hall. Casimir also established the Krakow Academy, today the Young Elonian University, the second oldest university in Central Europe. And to protect all of these new building projects, he heavily fortified Poland by building a series of imposing forts and walls around his perimeter. Most of all, Casimir is remembered as a progressive, tolerant king. In the 14th century, other nations were deporting or even interning their Jewish subjects, who were commonly scapegoated for anything that went wrong. But the enlightened and kindly Casimir actively encouraged Jews to come to Poland by granting them special privileges, often related to banking and trade, establishing the country as a safe haven for Jews in Europe. Casimir the Great was the last of Poland's long-lived Pius dynasty. Although he left no male heir, at least no legitimate one, Casimir's advances set the stage for Poland's golden age of the 14th to 16th centuries. After his death, Poland united with Lithuania against the common threat of the Teutonic Knights. The Jagiellonian dynasty was born, and Poland became one of Europe's mightiest medieval powers. If I bought my ticket for the Royal Stateroom or any of the other museums, I might want to stop and tour that now. I can enter them here from this courtyard. The Royal Staterooms appear to be the most interesting of the museum. While precious to Poles, these rooms are mediocre by European standard, but still, it is the best of the Wawel museums. I'll wander through some ho-hum halls to get to the throne room with 30 carved heads in the ceiling. According to legend, one of these heads got mouthy when the king was trying to pass judgment, so its mouth has been covered to keep it quiet. Then I'll walk along the outdoor gallery, enjoying views down into the courtyard, before heading upstairs. These top floor rooms are the best, with remarkably decorated wooden ceilings, gorgeous leather-tooled walls, and 16th century Brussels tapestry. 140 of the original series of 300 still survive. Wandering these halls with their period furnishings, I can get a feeling for the 16th and 17th century glory days of Poland, when it was a leading power in Eastern Europe. The Senate room, with this throne and fine tapestries, is the climax of the tour. A second museum that I might be interested in if I bought my ticket is the Crown Treasury and Armory. This is also entered through the courtyard, and here I'll see a decent collection of swords, saddles, and shields, ornately decorated muskets and crossbows, and cannons in the basement. Once done with the museums, I want to exit back into the courtyard, and there I want to head back out to the side of the cathedral to the Field of History. The Field of History is a hilltop and has seen lots of changes over the years. Casimir the Great turned a small fortress into a mighty Gothic castle in the 14th century. Today, you'll see the cathedral and a castle complex, but little remains of Casimir's grand fortress, which burned to the ground in 1499. In the grassy field across from the cathedral, I can see the foundations of two Gothic churches that were destroyed when the Austrians took over Bavel in the 19th century and needed a parade ground for their troops. They built the red brick hospital building beyond the field and now used by the Bavel administration. I can head across to the gap in the buildings beyond the field to the viewpoint over the Vestula. If I belly up to the wall, I can enjoy the panorama over the Vestula River and Krakow's outskirts. From here, I can see some unusual landmarks, including the old wavy-roofed building just across the river, which houses the Manga Japanese Art Gallery. The symmetrical little bulge that tops the highest hill on the horizon is a Kosciuszko mound, erected in 1823 to honor the Polish and American military hero. The mound, which was recently reinforced with steel and cement to prevent it from eroding away, is actually made of soil that was brought here from battlefields where the famous general fought, both in Poland and the American Revolution. Now, if I look directly below me along the riverbank, I'll find a fire-belching monument to the dragon that was instrumental in the founding of Krakow. Once upon a time, a prince named Krek founded a town on Bavel Hill. It was the perfect location, except for the fire-breathing dragon who lived in the caves under the hill and terrorized the town. Prince Krek had to feed the dragon all of the town's livestock to keep the monster from going after the townspeople. But Krek, with the help of a clever shoemaker, came up with a plan. They stuffed a sheep's head with sulfur and left it outside the dragon's cave. The dragon swallowed it and before long developed a terrible case of heartburn. To put the fire out, the dragon started drinking water from the Vestula. He kept drinking and drinking until he finally exploded. The town was saved and Krakow thrived. If I went head down to see the Vestula and the dragon close up, I could take a shortcut through the nearby Dragon's Den or Schmutzza Yama and enter at the little copper-roofed brick building. It's just a 135-step spiral staircase and a few underground caverns, but worthwhile only as a quick way to get from the top of the bell down to the banks of the Vestula. There's a 3 zloty pay it machine, coins only. This ends my Bavel Castle tour. What I want to do is walk down to the dragon and then, walking along the Vestula, head to my next destination, Casimir's, the Jewish quarter of town. As I finish the Dragon's Den, I'll turn left and, walking away from the castle, meander down the beautiful promenade along the Vestula until I come to Dietla, which is going to divide either way beside a green belt. And about the fourth block, I will come to Stradomska, and there I'll turn right for one block, turn left on Bira Mieselsa, and in one long block, turn right again on Bozego Kiawa. And after two blocks, I should come to the Corpus Christi Basilica. The Corpus Christi Basilica, also known as the Basilica Bozego Kiawa in Polish, is located in the Kazimierz district of Poland and is a Gothic church founded by King Kazimierz III, Kazimierz the Great, in 1335. The basilica was erected in stages between 1340 until about the mid-15th century, and it was intended as a monastery church, which explains the large size plot on which it stands and the presence of a monastic cemetery next to it. In 1404, King Vladislav II had given it to the canons regular of the Lateran congregation brought in from Płocko. The interior is a mixture of Polish Gothic and impressive Polish Baroque architecture with structural features such as the marvelous Baroque high altar, a bolt-shaped pulpit from 1750, and the organ. The church was robbed clean and the interior utterly devastated by the soldiers of the 1655 Swedish invasion, which explains the prevalence of Baroque in its current decoration. The church is often said to be one of the most beautiful Baroque in Central Europe. Bartolomeo Berici, the famous Renaissance artist who designed Sigmund's Chapel at Babel, is buried here. It has three naves, and in the Gothic style, the pulpit, which features that golden boat with oars and a mast even, is actually held up aloft by two mermaids. The crowning glory was once the towering golden altarpiece, although it may be removed for renovation. According to legend, a robber who had stolen a precious relic from another church repented on this spot and abandoned it here. The priest in pursuit saw a strange light emanating from the ground and discovered their sacred prize and founded the church here in recognition of the miracle. The neighborhood of Kazimierz is a historic heart of Krakow's once thriving Jewish community. After years in neglect, the district is being rediscovered. It's basically a local neighborhood, maybe a little run down, with a handful of Jewish cemeteries, synagogues, and restaurants. From the basilica, exit to my left and turn immediately to my left on Subitego Brvarzinka. Walk about four long blocks to Javor and then turn left. And just down the street, I should find the Galica Jewish Museum. The Galica Jewish Museum focuses on the present rather than the past. With a series of photographs displayed around a restored Jewish furniture factory, the permanent Traces of Memory exhibit shows today's remnants in yesterday's Judaism in the area around Krakow, a region known as Galicia. From forgotten synagogues to old Jewish gravestones flipped over and used as doorsteps, these giant postcards of Jewish artifacts with good English descriptions ensure that an important part of this region's heritage won't be forgotten. Complementing the permanent collection are also temporary exhibits. Exiting the museum, I'll return the way I came to my right and then turn immediately right on Zwartego Brvarzinka and go one block and again turn my right onto Bartosza. Just before I enter the old town square on Spiroka, on my right is the Starry Synagogue. Six different synagogues are in Kazimierz. Each of the interiors is a variation on the same theme. A large central prayer hall, often with an altar, facing east toward Jerusalem where the Torah is kept. The elevated platform in the center, sometimes surrounded by a cage-like structure, is the equivalent of a pulpit in a Christian church. There may be a balcony or an arcade where the women would worship separately. The red brick Stara Synagogue is the oldest surviving Jewish building in Poland and is now a good three-room museum on local Jewish culture with English descriptions. Most of the exhibits are on display in the impressive main prayer hall. From here, I can continue up Spiroka through Old Town, possibly stopping to browse and have some refreshment, and continue on to Rimu Synagogue and the Old Cemetery. As I stroll ahead to the next destination, some words about Jewish Krakow. After King Kazimierz the Great encouraged Jews to come to Poland in the 14th century, a large Jewish community settled in and around Krakow. According to legend, Casimiris the king established Casimiris the village for his favorite girlfriend, a Jewish woman named Esther, just southeast of the city walls. By the way, if I'm curious what Casimiris looked like, then take a look at the 50s Woody note, because Casimiris the Great is on the front, and on the back is his capital, Cracovia, and the most important town he founded, Casimiris. It's a cute legend, but the village of Casimiris didn't really become a Jewish enclave until much later. By the end of the 15th century, there were large Jewish populations, both Casimiris and in Krakow. Krakow's Jewish community and the university students clashed, and when a destructive fire broke out in 1495, the Jews were blamed. The king at the time forced all of Krakow's Jews to move to Casimiris. Casimiris was an autonomous community with its own town hall, market square, and city walls, though many Jews still commuted into Krakow's main square to do business. Within Casimiris, the Christian West and the Jewish East neighbors were also separated by a wall. But by 1800, the walls came down, Casimiris became a part of Krakow, and the Jewish community flourished. By the start of World War II, 65,000 Jews lived in Krakow, mostly in Casimiris, making up more than a quarter of the city's population. When the Nazis arrived, they immediately sent most of the Jews to the ghetto in the eastern Polish city of Lublin. Soon after, they forced Krakow's remaining 15,000 Jews into a walled ghetto at Podgorze, across the river. The Jews' cemeteries were defiled and their buildings ransacked and destroyed. 1942, the Nazis began transporting Krakow's Jews to death camps, including Przeworsk, just on Krakow's outskirts, and Auschwitz. Many others were worked to death in the Podgorze ghetto. Only a few thousand Krakow Jews survived the war. Today's Krakow has only about 200 Jewish residents. During the communist era, this waning population was ignored or mistreated. But in recent years, Casimiris has enjoyed a renaissance of Jewish culture, thanks largely to the popularity of Schindler's List, which was partly filmed here. Look for handwritten letters from Spielberg and the cast in local restaurants, such as Ariel. While few Jews live here now, the spirit of Jewish tradition lives on in the many synagogues as well as in the cemeteries. And remember, Schindler's factory is just but a few miles outside of this city. The Rimu Synagogue dates from 1553 and is active and fully renovated. There's a 5 zloty fee, but that also includes the old cemetery. The hours are erratic, so possibly nothing will be open. The old cemetery is one of two interesting Jewish museums. The small Stary Cimeteras was used to bury members of the Jewish community from 1552 through 1800. It has been renovated, so in a way, it actually feels newer than the new cemetery. After the new cemetery was opened in 1800, this cemetery gradually fell into disrepair. What remained was further desecrated by the Nazis. In 1950s, it was discovered, excavated, and put back together. Shattered gravestones form a mosaic wall around the perimeter. As in all Jewish cemeteries, you may see small stones stacked on the graves, originally placed over desert graves to cover the body and prevent animals from disturbing it. Behind the little synagogue to the left, the tallest tombstone next to the tree belonged to Moses Acero, a.k.a. Rimu, an important 16th century rabbi. He is believed to have been a miracle worker, and his grave was one of the only ones that remained standing after World War II. The knee-high metal receptacle nearby is for written prayers. When leaving the old cemetery, I can continue left on Zvirovka and turn right immediately on the first street, Miodova. And there, if I walk two blocks and cross under the railroad tracks, I'll come to the new cemetery. after the railway bridge, just jog a little bit to my left, and there on the right will be the gate. If I decide to skip this cemetery because of time, then right off of Medova, I'll turn left onto Starovishlina, and that will take me into Krakow's Old Town. And while I walk to Old Town, I'll learn about the new cemetery. The much larger new cemetery has graves of those who have died after 1800. Nazis vandalized this cemetery, selling many of its gravestones to stonecutters and using others as pavement in concentration camps. Many of the gravestones have since been returned to their original positions. Other headstones could not be replaced and were used to create the moving mosaic wall and Holocaust memorial, which is on the right as I enter. Most gravestones are in one of four languages: Hebrew, generally the oldest, especially if there's no other language, Yiddish, a mix of Hebrew and German, Polish for the Jews assimilated into the Polish community, and Germans for the Jews who assimilated into the German community. The earliest graves are simple stones, while later ones imitate graves in Polish Catholic cemeteries, larger, more elaborate, and with a long stone jutting out to cover the body. Some new-looking graves have old dates. These are most likely put here well after the Holocaust or even after communism by relatives of the dead. From the new cemetery, retrace my steps back down Medova underneath the trestle and turn right down Starovishlina, and there I'll walk a couple of long blocks and I'll come to the Planty. The Planty encircles old Krakow and replaced the falling down city walls. Krakowians decided to tear down those walls and fill in the moat and created this beautiful garden. Once I reach the Planty, I'll walk right through the gardens to the area of St. Florin's Gate. I'll enter Old Town again at St. Florin's and immediately turn to my right along the wall and enjoy the walk through the starving students who are hawking their works in this wonderful local gallery of artworks. I might find something for my bedroom wall at home. Then turn left at the next street, and there should be the Princess Czartoryski Museum. This eclectic collection, displaying armor, handicrafts, arts, and paintings, and also a very rare Da Vinci painting, is one of Krakow's best known and maybe overrated museum. It could be closed, but if not, it might be worth a visit. It closes at 6 p.m., so if I'm running out of time because the major portraits may not even be in the museum, then I might want to go on down to the wonderful stained glass of the Wypianski Museum just a couple of blocks away. If I decide to skip the museum or it is closed, then skip to the next chapter. The Czartoryski Museum is inspired by Poland's 1791 constitution, Europe's first. Princess Isabella Czartoryska began collecting bits of Polish history and culture. She fled with the collection to Paris after the 1830 insurrection, and 45 years later, her grandson returned it to his present Krakow location. When he ran out of space, he bought part of the monastery across the street, joining the buildings with a fancy passageway. The Nazis took the collection to Germany, and although most of it has been returned, some pieces are still missing. If the museum is open, then I can wander around the ornate rooms, the ornate armor, including a ceremonial Turkish tent from 1683 Siege of Vienna, plus feathered hussar armor, tapestries, treasuries, porcelain figures. Rounding out the exhibit are painting galleries of Italian, French, and Dutch, and Baroque. The museum is also home to Krakow's two greatest artistic treasures, one originating not from Poland, but from Italy, and the other Netherlands. One is the work of Renaissance genius and the other a Dutch master. I'm not likely to be able to view either of these while at the museum if it's closed. Lady with the Ermine, 1489 to 1490, is a Da Vinci masterpiece. It's only 21 by 16 and a simple portrait of a teenage girl in one of the most influential paintings in art history and a rare surviving work by one of the history's greatest. The girl is likely Galleriana, the young mistress of the Duke of Milan, Leonardo's employer. The ermine, white during winter, suggests several overlapping meanings, including a symbol of chastity, thus praising Cecilia's questioned virtue, and a naughty reference to the Duke's nickname, Ermilino. Notice that his mistress is usually stroking the ermine. Painted before the Mona Lisa, the portrait was immediately recognized as revolutionary. Cecilia turns to look off camera at someone. Leonardo catches her in an unguarded moment, giving the viewer a behind-the-scenes look unheard of in the days of the posed face-front formal portrait. Her simple gestures and faraway gaze speak volume about her inner thoughts and personality. Leonardo tweaks the generic Renaissance pyramid composition by turning it to three-quarters angle and softening it with curved lines from her eyes, down her cheek, and sloping shoulders, then doubling back across her folded arms. The background, once gray and blue, was painted back in the 19th century. The Lady with an Ermine is one of the only three surviving oil paintings by Leonardo. Is better preserved than her famous cousin, the Mona Lisa, and possibly more beautiful. Just recently, it was found that the master's fingerprint was literally pressed into the painting. The other famous painting is Rembrandt's Landscape with the Good Samaritan, painted in 1638. This small, remarkably detailed painting depicts the popular parable. On the right, the barely visible Samaritan helps the wounded, half-naked man onto his horse as a little boy and girl look on. To the left, much further down the road, just beyond the waterfall and bridge, find the two tiny figures walking, the priest and the Levite, who had passed the injured man by. The churning sky with beautiful sunlight clashing against black clouds seems to reflect the inner conflict that comes with doing the right thing. Or not. Instead of using a strict interpretation of the parable's Holy Land setting, Rembrandt chooses to combine disparate elements, such as the juxtaposition of classic Dutch windmills with the domed city of Jerusalem in the distance, to make the parable feel even more universal and immediate. The Wapiansky Museum is going to give me a closer look into Stanislav Wapiansky's stained glass and wall paintings, like I've seen in St. Francis Basilica. I'll just continue down the street from the Princess's Museum and enter back into the main square. And when I arrive there, I'll turn right on Schweizpanska Street and walk about a block beyond the square to the corner of Swolkowska Street, and there should be the Wapiansky Museum. It's housed in a renovated mansion, and the museum traces the personal history and artistic development of this Młoda Polska poster boy. What is Młoda Polska? It's young Poland. Polish art in the late 19th century was ruled by positivism, a school with a very literal, straightforward focus on Polish history. Jan Matejko led the charge. But when the new generation of Krakow's artists came into their own in the early 1900s, they decided that the old school was exactly that. Though moved by the same spirit and goals as the previous generation, evoking Polish patriotism at a time when their country was being occupied, these new artists used very different methods. They were inspired by a renewed appreciation of folklore and peasant life. Rather than being earnest and literal, an 18th century Polish war hero on horseback, the new art was playful and highly symbolic. the artist frolicking in a magical garden in the idyllic post-Polish countryside. This movement became known as Młoda Polska, or Young Poland, an Art Nouveau with a Polish accent. And of course, the leaders of that, behind Meyerhofer, who was Wapienski's good friend and rival, and other names like Jakub Melchowicz and Olga Bozanowska, the main leader is Stanisław Wapienski. Living from 1869 to 1970, Wapienski was the leader of this movement. He produced beautiful artwork with simple drawings to the stirring stained glass images in Krakow's St. Francis Basilica. He was an expert at capturing human faces with realistic detail, emotion, and personality. The versatile Wapienski was also an accomplished stage designer and writer, and his patriotic play, The Wedding, about the nuptials of a big city artist and a peasant girl, is regarded as one of Poland's finest dramas. Entering the museum, I want to get my ticket and climb the stairs. Turn left at the top of the first flight of stairs and circle this floor clockwise. Find the room devoted to Wapienski's youth, including some of his precious childhood sketchbooks. In the next room are works, including designs for beautiful stained glass windows from his youthful collection with his teacher, Jan Matejko, and his friend, Meyerhofer. Together, they renovated St. Mary's Church. The applied art section shows off furniture that Wapienski designed and a fine pastel drawing of St. Mary's spires. Hidden behind a curtain to protect it from damaging sunlight, I can ask an attendant to raise it for me, is his design for the dramatic stained glass Apollo, which hangs in the house of the Medical Society and unfortunately closed to public. A room of portraits by various artists includes self-portraits by Wapienski himself. The next section demonstrates him as a playwright. You'll see costumes and sets he designed for his own plays and copies of his favorite works, which he also designed himself. Finally, more portraits, including some of the other artists, such as Wapienski's talented Młoda Polska compatriot, Melchowicz. In the stairwell, up to the third floor, are more stained glass designs, this time for the masterpiece God the Father, Let It Be from St. Francis Basilica. On the top floor, if I go left and circle the collection clockwise, I'll be seeing various furniture and lesser works by other artists, and then reach the model of the elaborate Acropolis that Wapienski planned for the top of Babel Hill, with a domed palace, an amphitheater, and a Circus Maximus. Nearby is a hunting painting of the Plantian winter, with the Babel Castle in the background. The next few rooms contain more stained glass designs and designs for the painted floral decorations of St. Francis Basilica. Then, filling another room are portraits of Wapienski's family, including his daughter Helenka, just waking up, and his wife breastfeeding their son Stas. Helenka circles around to get good views of both of them, appearing twice in the painting. Yet another Helenka portrait shows her curiously fingering a vase of flowers, and rounding out the collection is a room filled with countryside scenes. When ready, exit the museum back toward the Old Town Square. I need to consider my time. It's been a long day, and I might just want to call it a day here. Find a place on the square or along Florianska and near my hotel. Enjoy dinner and a beer. If it's early enough, before 5 p.m., I might want to try to get in one last stop. I'll describe here the Barbican and the fortress walls. Walk back up Florianska toward Florian's Gate and enter into the Planty. And there to the left is the Barbican. The last chapter will describe the Barbican and the fortress walls. Otherwise, find a place to sit down, enjoy a wonderful beer and the atmosphere of Old Town, and leave the last chapter for later. Victorian Gate is actually one of the remaining entranceway through the city walls, and it was just part of the overall fortress walls surrounding the city of Kraków. If I haven't noticed already, be sure to find the little chapel inside the gate with a replica of the famous Black Madonna of Częstochowa, a very important religious symbol among all Poles. On the other side of St. Florian's Gate is the Planty, and to the left, the Barbican. What is now the Planty is the original moat and city wall area, and some remains of that wall can be seen from the Florian's Gate and around this area. Tartars invaded Kraków three times in the 13th century. After the first attack destroyed the city in 1241, Krakowians built this wall. The original rampart had 47 watchtowers and 8 gates. The big, round defensive fort standing outside the wall is a barbican. Structures like this provided extra fortification to weak sections. Imagine how it looked in 1500 when this barbican stood outside the town moat with a long bridge leading to the Florian Gate, the city's main entryway. Today, I can pay 6 swoty to scramble along these passages and fortifications of the barbican. Though there's little to see inside, except that there are some reenactments occasionally once a month, but it will give me an idea of what these fortifications once looked like. The same ticket allows me to scramble along the surviving stretch of the old town walls that flank the Florian Gate, and the entry to these is from the inside walls. Hopefully, I've been able to see everything that I want in Kraków today. This ends the tour, and now starts a time to find a pleasant cafe for people watching and for enjoying a wonderful cold Polish beer.